Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. We have a lively crowd, so we're happy to see it. Ahem. Thanks for joining us this afternoon for Peter, I'm gonna start calling people out by name. Thank you for joining us this afternoon for our panel. It's incredibly timely, and we're excited to speak to you today about it. Before we launch into it, we're going to do some brief introductions because the panelists really require no introduction, except for me, of course. I'm Rachel Albanese. I'm a partner in the New York office and co-chair of our U.S. restructuring practice at DLA Piper. On the end is Corinne Ball. She co-leads Jones Day's New York business restructuring and reorganization practice and leads the firm's European distressed investing and alternative capital initiatives. Katie Coleman is to my immediate right. She co-chairs the corporate reorganization and bankruptcy practice at Hughes Hubbard and sits on the firm's executive committee. The Honorable James M. Peck is to my immediate left. He is a retired Southern District of New York bankruptcy judge and currently sits as a judge on the Singapore International Commercial Court. Before joining the SICC, he chaired the cross-border insolvency and mediation practices at Morrison Foerster. And finally, on the far left is Edward Tillinghast III, who's a partner and practice group leader of Shepherd Mullins Finance and Bankruptcy Practice Group in New York. We have a lot to cover today, so I'm going to try to keep everyone to time. So please don't be offended, panelists, if I interrupt you or try to cut you off. As everyone can see, we have a kind of a clever name of this panel. The conference organizers thought of it, and as we were thinking about the relevance of this panel to the situation, we thought, well, new boss, same as the old boss. Is it true that Trump 2.0 is the same as Trump 1.0? That phrase there, by the way, comes from a 1971 song by The Who, and I'm not sure if everyone in this room even knows who The Who is.
Or was born in 1971.
Or was born in 1971. But I think, and with thanks to Judge Peck, today's New York Times has a great quote about what we're going to be talking about. And if you'll indulge me, I'll just read it to start. It has been 10 years now, as of Monday, since Donald J. Trump descended to the lobby of his namesake tower to announce his campaign for president. 10 years of jaw-dropping, woke-busting, scandal-defying, status quo-smashing politics that have transformed America for good or ill in profoundly fundamental ways. So today we want to talk about how have those ways impacted restructuring and how will they continue to impact restructuring. Judge Peck, what do you think?
Who knows? I mean that sincerely. It was also, thank you, a laugh line. I've been looking at this restructuring scene for a long time. I was alive in 1971. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that historical reference point later. I think there's a little question in my mind that the second Trump term is much more intentional and purposeful and organized, and even though it seems chaotic, and at least it seems chaotic to me, it's affecting our business in ways we don't yet know, because most of what we're dealing with is short term. We're dealing with the roller coaster, which is Peter Baker's reference to Trump over the last 10 years. The roller coaster of on again, off again, tariffs, tariff pauses, issues with migrant labor, that affected farms and meatpacking plants and restaurants and hospitality industries all over the United States. And that was reversed just last week, or at least paused. So I think what we're seeing is something new. I'm going to talk a little bit later about some historical reference points, but I think this is really different. I think this is a sea change, and I think that some of the changes that have taken place are not going to be so easy to later reverse. But I think the effects of this will not become manifest for a while. And if you look at the stock market, we're essentially at highs, notwithstanding, I think today's down a little bit. So if you look at the equity markets, that doesn't tell you very much. If you look at our industry, I think we're going to see a delayed response. More about that as we continue to talk. But I think we're looking at a new era. So I view Trump 2.0 as having such a significant impact on U.S. trade policy, and so many as yet not fully recognized and presumably unintended future consequences, that we're probably in for a very busy period next year. Now, as I say that, I'm also repeating something that people in our industry say every year.
Amen. One of the most visible and immediate impacts of the new administration are obviously the tariffs. In just a few weeks from today, the pause on President Trump's reciprocal tariffs is set to expire. Katie, Ed, can you talk about the current tariff landscape?
Katie, you want
to
start?
Yeah, sure. So we have some slides up there, and it takes 8 pages to put together the current tariff landscape, and I'm not going to go through all of that because...
By tomorrow it'll be different.
I was going to say.
There's kind of no point because by tomorrow it'll change anyway, but I think that's the point. I think that the bottom line, obviously, is that all tariffs are higher now, despite the pause of the reciprocal tariffs. All tariffs are higher now than when the new administration took office. I'm going to submit for consideration, though, it doesn't matter so much what they are or what they were or what they're going to be tomorrow or whether the pause goes away and comes back and goes away again. What matters is we're now in a landscape where what they are or what they might be is essentially unknowable to anybody except one person, well, maybe two or three people, and the people who are trading on those stocks, but that's a whole different thing. So the effect on restructuring is kind of the initially obvious point is a company that can't know what its costs are and what taxes it has to pay, because that's what tariffs are, is taxes, doesn't know whether it needs the relief available in Chapter 11 in the first place. So how are you supposed to decide what you should do if you can't, not only can you not plan, but you don't know if you need Chapter 11 or any restructuring. But the subtler effect is that we all know this. Nobody goes through Chapter 11 unless there is absolutely no alternative. Nobody likes it. Everybody hates the idea of it. You know, talk until you're blue in the face about the magic of bankruptcy and all the cool stuff you can do in bankruptcy. Nobody wants to do it. And now there's a glimmer of hope. If you talk to the right person, if you hire the right board member, if you change your CEO to somebody that somebody in the White House might like, maybe there's a glimmer of hope. Maybe you can go to the White House and cut a deal. In the famous words. And I think that the apparent possibility of that is, just like the judge said, I think that that is corrosive to the decision-making process, because it inserts a level of, yet another level of uncertainty and the ability of change. Now, if you go and get that deal, for example, just like the farmers and the hospitality people, got relief from ICE raids on their workplaces. That was reversed in a call yesterday morning. It lasted for 2 days. That was not really widely reported on, but now it's reversed, and now it's back to, raid them all. So even if you get that relief, you don't know if it's lasting, and that is a and I think the judge is absolutely right. We won't know until I think everybody's just kind of frozen right now and like, what's going to happen next, and what do I need, and what can I get? And that very uncertainty, I think, is what's having a real effect on restructuring that we can't see quite yet. But Ed, other thoughts?
Okay. So the slides, we're just going to skim through them because if you want to look at them in detail, you can. But they go through a series of the tariffs that were in place as of May 7th because we had to pick some day to do it. But the important part is Katie has said and Judge Peck has said, these are ever-changing. And as this slide, which is probably one the real takeaway, the expectation is they'll be higher, but it's very uncertain how high or how they're going to be applied and to what types of goods. So when you look at it from a restructuring perspective, which is what we're trying to do, I would look at the tariffs and the impact on manufacturing industries, both import and then you take the automotive industry where parts of cars, believe it or not, before it gets in your garage, can go over the borders up to 7 or 8 times. So potentially they're subject to tariffs multiple times. The other thing to look at is the DOGE cuts. And I was looking at a official list of the different alphabet agencies that have been cut. And just to give you a quick thumbnail, USAID, which got pretty much eliminated, DOD got cut, GSA, Health and Human Services, HUD, Treasury, USDA, CFPB, SEC, Veterans Administration, PBGC, and DOJ, all got cuts on the DOJ. So if you look at it, if you take a step back, there have been increase in costs or potential increase in costs that are uncertain as to amount from the tariffs. And then there's been cuts in revenue that affect many industries, including Department of Defense. And picture yourself, as many of us do, speaking with a board or a CFO, or on the other side, say the underwriters of a lender, trying to forecast revenue in this changing environment. It makes it very, very difficult. So those are the big impacts that I see in terms of contemplating bankruptcy. Is how do you, we've heard some of the sessions before talking about amount, how to set the amount of dips and the structure of dips. Well, if it's hard enough in a distressed company, but when you have an environment where things are changing daily, it makes it all the more difficult, both from the lender side as well as from the company side. So I think those uncertainties are, in many ways, there are different causes, but they're going to cause similar problems in the environment. As Judge Peck was saying, we'll probably see, an increase in bankruptcy. But I do take your note. We've all been saying that for years and years and years.
One thing I realized we forgot to do at the beginning was to give the usual disclaimer that nothing we are saying reflects the position of our firms or our clients, and I think that's particularly important in the context of today's panel. So we talked about some of the dramatic things that we're seeing related to economic impacts, but what are some other current economic or regulatory issues that are impacting parties involved in restructuring, companies, lenders, customers, suppliers, and the like? Anyone, this is kind of a free-for-all, so Ed, maybe we'll start with you, maybe some labor impacts.
Okay, so one of the things that particularly manufacturers are facing in the U.S., well, let me take a step back. The tariffs are largely meant to increase U.S. manufacturing, is the stated reason. But one of the difficulties as a country we find ourselves in is skilled labor is on the decline, and there's a lack of it. This goes from across almost all industries. And there's been years, and this has been going on for years, and there's some statistics where there's a need for 4.6 million workers that are skilled laborers in the U.S. And just looking at our neighboring state, Connecticut, which I was able to find some statistics for, 80% of the manufacturing companies in Connecticut, many of which are defense-related, are having severe difficulties retaining employees and getting employees. And it's not just an issue of wages or benefits. It's they're just not there. And the impact on that, it ripples out into the supply chain, which is something we heard a lot about during COVID, and the media seems to have largely changed its focus from supply chain. But the reality is many industries are adversely affected by supply chain issues, and those are all linked to lack of labor.
Well, in particular, I would say that the automotive industry, which has been hit by the tariffs, is a particularly fragile supply chain, because if you don't get X part, your entire factory goes down, and you have to shut down the line, and that can be devastating. So I do think that there are, and there must be other industries. I just happen to know about that one, but there must be other industries that are similarly affected. Retailers, for example, having to put in orders, and it takes 30 to 40 days to get goods across the water from China, and you don't know how much you're going to have to pay on those goods when they hit the port. It's not as if the tariffs are set when they leave. They're set when they get there.
And whether there'll be anyone at the port to unload them.
That is also true.
And something that even compounds it more is if you really sort of get into various industries, be it automotive is a good example, and there are many other manufacturers, that a well-run, efficient company is not going to keep a large amount of inventory for their parts, because that there's a cost associated with that. To have that inventory of parts sitting...
I beg to differ. I mean, COVID, everybody went through supply chain. I think the one word you've all heard, one, I think we're going to have a lot of fun. I don't think it's necessarily going to be bankruptcy. But if you just look at the executive orders, that's what we're talking about, and who the targets are. And the ones they missed were the NSF grants, affects an awful lot of medical companies, pharmas. We missed the NIH. We missed higher education. And what about NPR? And then this morning's news about pharma. Well, gee, we're going to take direct advertising and strangle it, or make it no longer tax deductible. So where's all the collateral damage on this? We've kind of talked about shipping, but it's going to be media. We already have Morelli, to Ted's point, on auto. We already have At Home, to the point on retailers. But what do we really have? We have uncertainty. Who loves uncertainty? Who thrives on disruption? Certainly Trump, very, very comfortable, very, very comfortable in litigation. He's trying to move us to a deal-based governance. Yeah, but he's the guy that breached a lot of contracts. How many of us actually dealt with Trump defaults? So knowing that that's the environment we're in, what does it mean for us? Let's follow the guys that make money in disruption. Who are those? Hedge funds. Shareholder activists. Just look at the news this morning. Forward Air is going to be forced into a breakup sale. Phillips 66, big and little, forced by activists into a breakup. Who's going to do the breakup? I mean, I almost am reminded, Winston Churchill once said, never let a good crisis, which this is, go to waste. So I think Ted is right. I think all these CFOs thought they had it nailed, have all their costs down, just-in-time inventory. But is that the right model when you're in an era of deal-based governance and uncertainty? Maybe not. I think they're really going to need to be resilient. And if you're so inflexible, you're going to go down swinging, but you're going down. But that's where they need us. I think, is to help them understand where you're just not resilient enough. If you have 15 lines of business under one consolidated financial model, you can have tariffs or DOD hit maybe one line or two. But your whole business is going to be affected if you don't realign. But speaking about that 91-day LME, you heard about that at lunch, right? So what great story does the CEO have to say, I want you all to review all our business lines, and we're going to change the way we do things, and we're going to move around our financing? I think they're going to have a heck of a defense to a fraudulent conveyance, a lot better than our LME friends, because this is the time that they should be looking. This is the time there should be a jump ahead, and they're going to need help. And I think, you know, what was it you said, Jim? This is a time where bring your guns, money, and lawyers. And I think that that's probably right.
We're going to get more to that in a couple questions, but I know that there are other economic impacts that companies have to, and customers and suppliers have to be thinking about. I mean, what about interest rates, Judge Peck?
Interest rates are probably down the list from some of the things we've been talking about. I'm at my risk in disagreeing with something that Corinne would say, but I'm going to do it anyway.
You're separated by two people. we'll cover you.
I think it's extraordinarily difficult to position yourself the right way in a period of extraordinary volatility. I have never seen a period in at least my lifetime in American economic history when there is so much happening, everything, everywhere, all at once, just like that movie title. It's every single day we're drinking from a fire hose of economic news. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a question of taking a deep breath and deciding where you actually want to play in this environment, which is fraught with risk. One of the areas that I think probably is less risky and more stable is interest rates. But 5 years ago, we were talking about a risk-free rate of about 55 basis points. Today, we're over 4%. I think there's concern. Remember inflation? Remember we had inflation? We're not talking about it so much anymore. So I think that the tariff concern associated with inflation is that there's going to be a renewal of something that we used to call stagflation, which could have an impact on the Fed's willingness to cut interest rates. And they've been on a pause for the last approximately 6 months. So where's that going to go? I don't know. Is it going to go anywhere down to the point that it was when we were all saying cost of capital is essentially free? No. We're kind of in a normal interest rate environment right now. But I think that it's, in relative terms, low on the list of risk factors, but there's a whole bunch of low interest rate debt that's going to be hitting a refinancing moment soon enough. And that's going to be a stressor on any number of businesses, especially middle market.
You suggested that geopolitical issues, everything's coming at us all over the place. When I think of that, I think of geopolitical issues, which I know you were going to describe. I mean, well, we're all living it. But
there are so many of them. Where to start? But I think it feeds into, and this is something that really cannot be controlled by the administration. But so I think that, you know, when we're talking about the difference between 1.0 and 2.0, I think we're probably focusing on the changes that the administration itself is making. But when you add into that, obviously, you know, just in the last week, increasing, you know, a war in the Middle East, essentially, that does not seem to be necessarily capable of being resolved. The continuing, you know, continuing war in Ukraine. All of those things have other sort of macro effects on, you know, on international investment and where countries are going to put their money. So I think that just sort of turbocharges everything. And you also get the spectacle of, you know, last week we were talking about immigration. The week before that we were talking about tariffs. This week we're talking about international conflict and, you know, whether we should spend our money building a golden dome so that, you know, so that we can intercept missiles as well. It is, to Judge Peck's point, it is this you know, sort of irresistible flood of stuff and coming into business planning. Obviously, some businesses are going to be affected more than others by all of the international and geopolitical stuff. But and then the G7 and what happened there. It's like trying to solve, you know, it's like trying to solve a multifactorial, you know, I know one person who isn't playing four-dimensional chess, but it you kind of have to in order to plan. So I wanted to hear, and I know we will, but more of what Corinne was talking about what, you know, what should boards do? What should CEOs be doing in planning for dealing with all this stuff and planning for resiliency? Because that's all you can do. You can't plan for, okay, in 4 weeks we're going to have 80% tariffs. What are we going to do then? You don't know that. You have to plan for how to resolve around that. And I think it's going to have very big consequences, which we probably won't see for 5 or 6 years, on D&O litigation, you know, board liability for failing to anticipate. The defense is obviously, you know, nobody expected the Spanish Inquisition. How could we possibly have anticipated this? On the other hand, it's not like it was a surprise. We heard in the campaign about all these things that were going to happen, mass deportations, higher tariffs. We heard about all that, and my guess is that the planning that went around it, this is a pure speculation, but planning went around it probably was not very much because, again, you know, is he really going to do it? Well, yes, but we didn't know that then. And can a board be held liable? So I want people who addressing these issues more than me to talk about that, because I think that's a fascinating point for all of us who are advising these folks.
Great point and great segue. Let's go back to Corinne and talk about some best practices when you're advising a company or a board in the midst of just of this crazy disruption, you know, from internal or external forces.
Typically, boards would have a risk management function as part of their audit committee. The problem is that a lot of that is under control of the CFO. Resiliency review is really undoing whatever your CFO has done. So you can imagine you're going to be very welcome. But someone in the C-suite is going to wear it. And I think they have to we have to encourage them and their boards to really actively assess how anti-fragile are they? How resilient are they? And let's just look around what's going on. Yeah, Harvard decided to fight. Big deal. Litigation takes time and money. Did anyone notice that Yale is selling $2.5 billion of its alternative capital? Most universities around the country right now are raising cash like you would not believe because their boards of trustees who are active are saying, we have to be ready for anything. We don't know what's coming next. We don't know if we're a target. What if student loans are cut off? So we're already seeing that. And I think then we're seeing what Ted's talking about. JetBlue this morning, anyone see what happened to their stock? Oh, they're going to be activists in that one. It went way down. They're tightening their belt really hard. So I do think that when we talk about the targets of all these executive orders, we also have to be mindful of the collateral damage. I mean, think about it. Pharma pulls out of direct consumer advertising. Right now, they're the third highest revenue source for all media. I think there's going to be some collateral damage there. Boundless broadcast won't be the only one. If you were in media and you were looking at $1 out of every $3 being under threat, What are you doing to stay resilient? So I do think that the financial professionals may need the door opened by the lawyers, but being resilient is important, and it's kind of ironic. The organizations that are really moving fast are rich, well-endowed higher education. Did anyone notice that the endowment tax, since Harvard decided to fight and Yale decided to sell, it's now 1.4% on endowment income? The big, beautiful bill would have raised that to 24%. Another huge impact. The Senate knocked it back to 8%. But these guys are already ahead planning. I think corporate America is slower, and it's going to have to start doing the same thing. Connecticut's employment is very DOD-oriented, as I read your sources, Ted, this morning. That's going to be cut back. Who knows? But the companies making defense are doing very well. So I do think that we have to grab the opportunity to work with them. And be mindful, you are undoing what in the era that Jim described of cheap capital, they put everybody under one financial model, one business line, one series of public reports, everything consolidated, streamlined. It doesn't work very well in terms of making you resilient. So I almost think that it's the era the CFO is going to start yielding more to the CEO, and I think they're going to see it. We're going to need a few breakups, and by that I mean a few more activist attacks. They're coming, and they're going to need us to implement them. How do you sell these businesses out of a huge conglomerate? But for what it's worth, I throw it out there. Litigation takes years of money, and that's not really an answer for corporate America or anyone. On the other hand, PE, by definition, the way it's set up, look at them. They're pretty resilient. Their portfolio companies are all financed separately, so they lose one. Who cares?
For the panel as a whole, what can companies do as a practical matter when they're faced with this kind of situation? You know, they're going to be looking to their lawyers and saying, how do we govern? The board will say, this is unprecedented. What do we do?
Well, I think the first premise is, remember that one of the two principal duties of directors is the duty of care, and that includes the premise to your question, which is they ask us. And I think that obviously it's somewhat self-serving for lawyers to say, you know, it would really be helpful if you would retain us, and you don't have to listen to us. You can make a decision based on what you hear from us, but you need to hear from us. And that
process.
As a process point, it almost, I'm fond of saying, it's probably a little overstated, as I want to do, but it almost doesn't matter what decision a board makes as long as it has a plethora of information to make it on, because you can't get nailed for not doing your duty of care as long as you retain counsel. The problem is, and I think Corinne's point is absolutely correct, PE is set up to be more resilient by its very structure. The problem is that structure usually all funnels up to one relatively megalomaniacal person. It's usually a guy. And I would say always, but I'm probably wrong about that. But it all funnels up to one person, and the practice of putting your employees of that overarching PE owner sponsor entity on the boards of every single one of your portfolio companies, no bueno, because they work for you, and therefore they're not going to be able to do their fiduciary duty in the way that they need to and protect themselves from litigation, in any eventual failure of the company. So I think that PE, and I'm sure this will fall on deaf and hostile ears. I think there may be actually a dartboard with my face on it that's some PE shops for giving this advice, but they should really look at their corporate governance and prepare for the hard questions, because they're not going to get it all right, as Corinne points out. They're going to lose a few companies. They already do.
That's okay.
And that's okay. we ought to consider whether that's the way it works. You can't, everybody can't be above average. There have to be companies that, for tariffs or taxes or any other taxes or any other number of reasons. I mean, the second to last buggy whip manufacturer was, should have been doing some planning too, but they were the last ones. It happens, and it should be allowed to happen. But the governance point is: get the information, listen to advice, hire experts, not just lawyers, but financial advisors as well.
Well, as part of that, I think, particularly in the middle market, be it PE or otherwise, both public and private, to the extent their business is significantly tied to directly or indirectly to government contracts, I think they have to be very cautious because historically most of those government contracts were seen as an annuity that went on forever because the ultimate program with the prime contractor, be it defense or be it whatever, was forever essentially. I think it's fair to say that many of those programs could be cut in a moment's notice. And it's not unusual, as I'm sure some of the panelists and some of the people in the room have seen, some of these middle market companies, in some cases, 80 to 90% of their revenue is tied to two or three contracts. And that puts them in a very risky place. And they're great contracts as long as they last. But those kinds of things could disappear overnight. So I think that's going to put an emphasis on trying to diversify.
What about the withdrawal of federal funding and potentially even FEMA funds?
That's another one. I mean, the list of different agencies that were cut, either by grants or contracts, and Corinne raised the educational world, universities and schools. I mean, you have to wonder how institutions can bear cuts of hundreds of millions and sometimes billions of dollars. And the same goes with some very, very large nonprofit organizations that have been cut that had USAID contracts in terms of what's going to happen.
They are terminable at will.
Oh, yeah.
And you're stuck. But one other thing, has anyone heard about what's now called collateralized finance obligations? It's a relatively recent development.
No.
Well, one of the things that's going on, because private equity, as you know, the investors in private equity have very limited liquidity. And they're trying to get cash and get ready to be resilient. The same with private credit. There's no liquidity for the institutions that invest in it. So two things are going on. You've got Apollo running around trying to make a market in private credit, which we as lawyers have to look for on the resiliency side for our companies. You know that list of restricted players that you can't transfer my private credit loan to? Let's check that box as we're looking at all of this. And then the other one, the collateralized finance obligations, it just reminds me of Lehman Brothers, The Big Short. What it is institutions can now contribute their private equity investments, and in theory, their private credit investments into an SPV, which will in turn create and issue rated securities by the rating agency that rates private equity and private credit. I think one of them is Sean Egan-Jones. And they will issue like Class A certificates, Class B certificates, Class C certificates. Does anyone remember this in the GFC? When even the A-rated paper ended up not getting paid, it's back. Come on, guys, we've seen this movie. It's back, but it's everyone trying to make sure they can have cash to be resilient. So here we go. I think we're going to be seeing it more and more. And to Rachel's point, what do we as lawyers do? You've got a company that's going to rely on private credit. Have you really looked at the restrictions on who they can transfer it to? You're going to want a growing list. I don't know who should be on the list. Probably your clients, but
yeah. But even that's obviously true. But of course, but even look at the development of the rights that private credit is taking in connection with the existence of the default. You don't have to foreclose. I mean, you give notice of foreclosure, the company can file. you can simply flip the board. You've got a, you know, you've got a pledge of, you make them use a holding company structure, you get a pledge of the stock, and the pledge is accompanied by a proxy. And Delaware courts don't love them, but they will enforce them as long as they have a three-year term. And then you provide that the minute there's a default, you can exercise that proxy, vote the rights, and flip the board. So that's, you know, that's what's happening now, and you can't do a darn thing about that as the company. Now, I have heard that in new financings, new private credit financings, there are anti-board flip provisions. You have to give the lender has to give the company notice in order to allow the company to file bankruptcy before the board gets flipped, and no bankruptcy is forthcoming unless the lender wants it to be. But my guess is that in a scenario where a company is desperate for the loan, you know, the private credit entity is not going to agree to that, and you're going to and you're going to be in the situation where you just, you know, hope like heck that you don't end up in a default situation. But the way those documents are drafted, there's probably a default every day.
That requires the company to have some leverage.
Yeah, exactly.
In negotiating those.
Well, it's kind of like the lunchtime panel was talking about in terms of the power being held by dip lenders. It's the same thing outside of bankruptcy. He who holds the checkbook, you know, manages everything in or out of bankruptcy.
There's not a market really for dip loans. It'd be hard to disagree with Judge Strain. But a lot of these LMEs, the first place they look is what they call finance away, which means looking at private credit just to create some competition for your existing lenders. But that means takeout.
Right.
But they'll generally be a lot nicer on certain things like notice. But one little footnote on those CLOs. Last week, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners approved buying those securities for all regulated insurance companies. That's a very big deal because they can only buy rated securities, right? But who do you think owns the insurance companies that push the NAIC to do this?
And there's nothing backing that up. This is just like the
no.
subprime.
Yeah, private equity owns the biggest insurance companies in the United States right now. So these are all signs of people moving to get cash and diversify and offload problems to other people. So as I said, you know, well, I didn't say it. Jim Peck said it. Bring your guns, money, and lawyers.
And financial advisors.
To be FAs, to be able, that's the money part, to be able to figure this out. But these are all indicative of things that people are doing to deal with uncertainty.
And as you point out, litigation is expensive. Not the answer. It's expensive, and it's after the fact. You have to wait until something has happened under almost all circumstances that we're talking about, commercial business consequences of doing a thing. You can't get a TRO to get the National Association of Insurance Commissioners to not approve that.
No,
because you haven't shown that there would be harm. We all know, sitting here, that there will be, and that, you know, you're offloading it, but you're offloading it right off into the Grand Canyon. I mean, there's nothing backing all of that stuff up.
Well, don't tell private equity that. All their investors
are
getting
reports. They wouldn't listen to me anyway. They never do.
You're on the dartboard.
I'm on the dartboard. And they're the smartest people in the room. So why would they listen to a lawyer?
They have good lawyers, too.
They do.
That's why they're doing it.
Yes.
That's exactly why they're doing it. Did anyone notice also we're going to have a tax? It's going to change our world. Those of us that do mass torts, there's another new tax. Litigation funders, most of whom are organized offshore. So to date, they've never paid taxes when they get a big payday and all their litigation funding loans get paid. Remember, they get 30, whatever percent of the recovery. Well, now they're going to get taxed. That might put some pressure on some plaintiffs' law firms. So I think we're going to have fun.
The old Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times.
It feels like these are singular times, but Judge Peck, is there a historical analog for any of what we're experiencing?
Okay, I'll be the historian in the room.
Please.
Maybe Corinne can help me.
The Over the Hill gang rides again?
So
you got your guns.
I think there are four dates that I'm going to reference, and I'm also going to make a kind of a general observation that we should stop being distracted by all that's going on. There's an awful lot that's in the financial news every single day, and an awful lot of people like us who get in front of audiences like you and say, the sky is falling. And it's different this time. Actually, it may be different this time. But I have lived through what I would wager are at least four, very significant financial setback times. One was in 1975. I was a young lawyer, and it was the height of the recession of 1973-1975. It was a real estate recession. I thought the sky was falling because the law firm that employed me went out of business. And I shortly thereafter ended up in the bankruptcy business. In 1977, I was representing New York Life Insurance Company and Prudential Insurance Company and a steel company bankruptcy, and it made my career. That's why I'm talking to you now. So just because bad things happen to you doesn't mean that it's a bad thing at the end of the day. 2008, I was minding my own business sitting in One Bowling Green when I was assigned the Lehman Brothers case. Some people involved in that case are here. It changed my life. It also changed the world. And that really changed the world. There's a book written by a history professor at Columbia University, Adam Tooze, called Crashed. It's a very, very big book. It's like an old New York City telephone book. It's that thick. And it's extraordinary, and I recommend it to you. But it essentially, and I can't summarize it, it essentially talks about the global financial crisis as the gateway to Trumpism. Occupy Wall Street. The kinds of political movements that were spawned by an economic crisis that had nobody going to jail. There were no consequences. It led to a diminishment in trust in all financial institutions, all governmental institutions, private institutions, the partisan split that we know about and live with. 2020, everything closed. We all expected that bankruptcy was going to be booming. Didn't happen so quickly, did it? So here we are in 2025, and I have no idea what's going to happen next. Can people hear me? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a microphone whose light is very faint, so it's hard to tell if the mic is on. So in 2025, we're gnashing our teeth about tariffs and labor being sent overseas back to their homes and attacks on Harvard and Columbia and other institutions, the long-term consequences of this, frankly, unknowable. And I'm going to agree with Corinne. Actually, I agree with her about a lot of things, but I'm agree with her on this point. People in this room and people in our industry are probably as well equipped as any professionals anywhere in being able to manage crisis. In fact, some people in our field consider themselves crisis managers. And so in a time of deep and profound uncertainty as to what's going to happen next, we've lived through this our our professional lives. I think the main difference is what makes this feel different. It feels like it's intentional on the part of Washington.
It feels or whoever like, the deep state is these days.
And because of that, it feels that, well, this is, we elected somebody to do this to us. Maybe we didn't expect that everything that is happening is something that was foreseeable. But the fault is in ourselves. It's our democracy. Nothing wrong with that. We can vote differently another time. And so I'm actually highly confident. I think we have a very resilient economy, much more resilient than I expected, frankly. Look at us. We have market highs. We have a very strong economy. Unfortunately, we've made some enemies among our allies. So our trade policy is, I think, broken. So it needs to get fixed. And we'll fix it.
Hear, hear. That deal-based governance is going to have some deal makers straighten it out before we're done. But on your history, I note the following. I think that 78-80, when interest rates, I know it's going to surprise you, were 20+%. City of New York almost failed. Wall Street, Felix Rowayton, my very first case, City of New York. Wall Street was in the golden age. It rescued the City of New York with Municipal Assistance Corporation. Very few people know it was the unions who bailed out New York and helped it make payroll back then to get to the Wall Street solution. 1987, long-term capital. Failed, but Wall Street to the rescue. It fixed it. That world changed in 1989 was when I got that call from Gene Corrigan, get Drexel, Burnham, and Lambert into Chapter 11 tonight, at least the holding company. Wall Street wasn't going to help Drexel at all. But look at what it gave rise to. Ken Mollis, Leon Black, I could go on and on. Mark Antanasio, Bob Beyer, Crescent Capital, Argosy, everyone you now know who they moved from highly confident high yield and they came up with a solution to a new way of looking at things, launching private equity. Then I agree with Jim, 2007, the credit downgrades. Wrecking, that was the canary in the coal mine to the GFC, 08, 09. But Wall Street couldn't rescue. The banks, banking in Europe was fundamentally sidelined. And look what happened, to Jim's point. Private credit swept in, filled the gap. Everybody got back on their feet. It was, frankly, it was American, not American source capital, but American managed capital that did it. And I'm with Jim. I think the same thing's going to happen again. I'm not sure what it will be, but 2020, COVID, same thing, got through it. Government inflated its balance sheet hugely, and we're still trying to deal with that. So we'll see. We'll see. Please, God, I hope he doesn't fire Mr. Powell. That would be dreadful.
Well, Judge Peck, you said toward the beginning, you said there were some consequences, and I agree with what both of you said. I think there is built-in resilience, and something will come up to replace what we may have lost. But you said at the beginning that there were some things that you thought would be harder to reverse. Can you expand on that a little bit? Do you want to? If you don't want to, it's okay.
Well,
I'm just interested.
I think I should make a point clear. One of the reasons that a retired bankruptcy judge is sitting before you as opposed to a currently sitting bankruptcy judge is that this was a hard panel to populate. with a sitting bankruptcy judge.
You couldn't.
This is a controversial topic in an environment in which certain people who speak out may feel that they're exposed to risk. So I'm going to answer the question anyway. I think that there is some things happening that will be virtually impossible to repair in the short run. Speaking for myself, I'm very concerned about our healthcare system and medical research and items of that sort, which have nothing to do with our field. But I'm concerned about a brain drain. I'm currently working on an international restructuring. It's private, has nothing to do with bankruptcy. The parties that I deal with are global. They're global funds, many of them, all over the world. It's a wonderfully exciting assignment. Wish I could tell you about it other than what I just said.
Next year.
Totally fascinating. I'm dealing with people who were educated in the United States. They went to foreign schools in different parts of the world. They came to the United States to go to Harvard and Emory and Stanford and places like that, NYU and Columbia too. Foreign students happen to be a tremendous intangible asset that benefits our country. Our relationships, I'm a globalist, our relationships with other countries are supported and fostered by the fact that we have friends, people who are educated here, people who are agents of our way of life. I'm very concerned when institutions like Columbia and Harvard are not in a position to assure themselves of research grants and assure themselves of foreign students. I think there are long-term adverse consequences associated with this, unrelated to our economy. And I could go on, but I won't.
Well, let's stay on the topic of democracy, which I'm extrapolating. But Katie, can you talk a little bit about some other challenges to the rule of law that we've seen in the context of, we've seen it in the context of immigration, where a single district judge attempts to issue a nationwide injunction or bind the government, and the government takes the position that they're not bound. What happens in a bankruptcy case? What is the court's remedy for a party who may ignore an order in bankruptcy?
Well, you know, I think that bankruptcy judges are, and I shouldn't speak as one because I haven't been one, and I'd be very interested in what Judge Peck thinks about this, but this is an issue that I think most judges don't have to think about, but bankruptcy judges do sometimes have to think about it in the context of non-U.S. actors. And what I think was spoken about a little bit on the earlier panel, if anybody caught the Chapter 11 versus the World panel, it's the issue of a creditor in Israel, say, or Kyrgyzstan, who is violating the automatic stay. And the U.S. judge has a real dilemma, because if he or she issues an order purporting to affect that person, they don't have personal jurisdiction. The worldwide stay is in effect. Actions taken in violation of the stay are void ab initio and have no effect. But tell that to somebody who just exercised remedies and against the debtor against whom remedies were exercised. So I think it's a long way of saying that bankruptcy judges have had to think about do I really want to issue this order if it's not going to be obeyed? Because I think that's what these judges now are facing. They're facing the consequence of, I know what the right answer is. The right answer is this is unlawful, you can't do what you did, and I should order you. The right thing in a normal circumstance would be to order you to stop doing it, and then you would stop doing it because Marbury versus Madison, et cetera, et cetera. That's what I think is under challenge, and so I would, not to completely deflect, but I would be really interested in how Judge Peck thinks about this challenge of, do you really want to issue an order if you have good reason to believe that it's not going to be obeyed, because then what do?
You don't issue orders like that ever.
You still?
Right.
I actually have direct experience. I mentioned this I was subbing for Judge Beckerman on one of the panels this morning, which dealt with that very subject. And so I'm repeating myself, so bear with me if you happen to have been in that audience. In the Lehman case, debtor's counsel brought to my attention that there was a major creditor based in Indonesia that was not complying with the automatic stay, and a motion was filed seeking an order that could then be brought to Indonesia to enforce the automatic stay. And I didn't issue that order. I publicly said something like, there's no need for the order because the automatic stay applies, and we should just arrange to have it enforced in Indonesia. But privately, I was thinking, I'm not going to issue the order and then and have it rebuffed because that would diminish my authority. And at least in that case, I was coloring outside the outlines. I was involved in something that the law really didn't entirely provide for because it was a major cross-border case with a lot involved. I'll say this, though. And this is consistent with the federal government and the third branch, our court system. I had the extraordinary privilege of sitting on one of the most significant bankruptcies of all time. And people would say, how did you get the case? People all over the world say, well, how did you get the case? And the answer was, it was random. It really was. It was random. The case was originally assigned to Stuart Bernstein, and because he was married to a partner at Weil Gotshal, he had to recuse himself, so I got it on the rebound. I got a life-changing benefit, I think it was a benefit, on the rebound. And having the case, there were all kinds of stories written, so how did this guy, he's only been on the bench for 2.5 years, what's he doing with this really large case? And people would say, well, did the government come in to talk to you? Did they try to influence you? No. In the entire time that I handled the case, I never heard from the government except in pleadings filed by DOJ or by the New York Fed or by some entity that needed to be heard. Everything was based upon pleadings filed and arguments made. I believe that the bankruptcy system is not going to be the least bit impacted, really, by anything that's going on right now.
Darn. I was kind of hoping. Since we do know that someone did stick their head above the parapet, which was the executive of the United States trustee. We don't have one now. And some of us have been really busy trying to figure out how to get the U.S. trustee focused in more productive areas.
Corinne, do you think that might be a benefit?
I think getting the U.S. trustee to focus on bankruptcy fraud, things like that, would be a real benefit rather than weighing in where everybody else is very happy. But we'll see. I do believe that sticking your head above the parapet has risks. I think that even for the U.S. trustees people, it has risks, but they're still doing their job. The other one, did everyone notice the suit that got filed yesterday? The ABA. The ABA authorized a lawsuit against the administration for what it's been doing to law firms. And I guess it's going to be, it was filed by Sussman Godfrey. So it's again, you know, the law firms don't want to be the ones. We don't want to be target. But the ABA is taking on that fight. So we'll see. We'll see. As I said, I agree with you, Jim. There's always a resilient answer, but there are real concerns. The brain drain is a very much a genuine one. And I think it affects more than Harvard and Yale. I think it affects a lot of institutes of higher learning. But by the same token, one might ask, want them, fund them. The government, doesn't anyone think that maybe Trump wanted a deal? Like, guys, if you just use your endowments for foreign students, I'll leave you alone. I just don't want to use government loans or government money to do it. But there was no discussion. I'm not saying that was right or wrong. I'm just saying Trump is not built that way. He's not built for the absolute no, and I think that's what Harvard said to him. So we will see how that turns out. What I've found kind of amazing is, I don't have any hear from Paul Weiss, but after Paul Weiss cut its deal, one of their litigation partners went on the board of Harvard to assist in this. So there are people, despite the risk, who are trying to keep a lid on it. And here, I hope they succeed.
From the perspective of the judiciary, however, I think that there are some judges who may be pulling their punches, but that doesn't happen in the bankruptcy court.
No.
It's just, we don't put anybody in jail. Well, we do if they commit contempt, potentially. But there's kind of a more subtle issue, which I guess I'll revert back to the question about, you know, what can't be reversed, what's irreversible here. I've committed my life from the point that I became a judge to the rule of law. And I really think that it's being challenged now in ways that cause all of us who are in the field to feel a stirring of our consciences and the need to perform at the highest level consistent with the rule of law. I had the great privilege of being appointed to the Singapore International Court about a year and a half ago, and people are very curious about that. It's a part-time job. It's a wonderful part-time job. And one of the things that's so wonderful about it, Singapore is a very small country, very exceptional kind of place. But it's totally committed to the rule of law. It is its greatest intangible asset. It's a country with no natural resources, but with extraordinary people and with a commitment to, some people might not like the way people who chew gum are dealt with, but it's a very orderly place, and it's a place in the midst of a region that's very unruly. It's in the midst of a region where it's very difficult to get legitimate, prompt, authoritative rulings from courts. And the rule of law, as a consequence, is an extraordinary asset. Let's never allow our commitment here to the rule of law to be chipped away in the name of expediency. It's what makes our country great.
I think that's a great ending. We have a few minutes left for questions, if anyone has any. Or we can end on Judge Peck's alternative MAGA.
Which was great, by the way.
Yes.
By the way, Singapore came to the fore. Do you remember Asia Pulp and Paper? It came to the fore in the Asian debt crisis, which, of course, was caused by George Soros right after he caused the Russian debt crisis in 97. But Singapore became, for all the deals we were doing and fixing in Asia, it was the orbital center of Asia, which since then has become the judicial center of Asia. But to the judge's enforcement point, one thing about Singapore that's very interesting is virtually everyone has money that passes in one way or another through Singapore. So they really haven't had an enforcement crisis. And I doubt that they will in the near term. But they will be a great restructuring forum on the international front for sure. So who's actually had to get a TRO from an executive order? Anybody? Who's been asked to prepare one?
Really?
Oh, yeah.
That must have been fun.
We'll do this because a lot of people thought they'd be under attack for their diversity policies, you know, when they didn't pull them. Fortunately, it hasn't happened. I think it kind of just makes me think that Trump has greater targets at the moment. And I think the point that you make, Katie, the global consequences of where we are and the level of trust around the world is kind of distracting him at the moment. We'll see.
He might come back to it.
Yeah, like he had to ditch G7 before Zelensky showed up.
Right.
Just amazing.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you, everybody.